Right, so read that piece from Romans, which I asked Ken particularly to read, not just the piece from Romans 13, 1 to 7, but bits from chapter 12 and bits that come after it in chapter 13. But if you're a follow-alonger, then we're looking particularly at Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7 today. And if you just read it, it sounds pretty clear-cut. God gives us governments because living with a structure of civil authority is what's best for the community. So we need to obey the laws of the land and be obedient to the government. How does that sit with you? Just take a space to feel in yourself how you actually respond to that, which is the straight reading of the text. A commentator on Romans, Douglas Moo, says, "Interpretation of this text is a history of attempts to avoid what seems to be its plain meaning." Because we're so aware of so many situations where the plain meaning is awful and where it's been used to support evil. And the chief modern example is Nazi Germany, where a theology of church quietism based on this text allowed or even actively supported the Holocaust. More recently, the US Attorney General, what's his name? Jeff Sessions quoted this verse to justify putting refugee children in cages on the Mexican border separated from their parents. He targeted his comments particularly at church leaders who were opposing that hardline policy, especially the Catholic Church. And it's exactly Jeff Sessions' kind of use of the text that another commentator on Romans, James Dunn and Douglas Moo are probably sort of two of the top five people writing on Romans. His commentary, he says, "When any government that is not serving God for the good of its citizens uses this text to maintain subservience, it is guilty of," I'm quoting, "a complete distortion and an abuse of both Paul's purpose and of its continuing scriptural significance." Any government not serving God for the good of the citizens, using it to maintain subservience, is a distortion and an abuse. And in a surprising move, both the liberal and the conservative commentators on this verse agree on something, that's the surprise, agree that if a law of the government directly contravenes the law of Christ, then we are under the law of Christ first, that we're obligated to follow what Christ says before the government. But there is wide disagreement about what would prevent us from following Christ. And that lies underneath the current conversation about religious freedom and protections of religious freedom in Australia. So what do we do with a text when the reading of it seems self-evidently wrong? When even the commentators at far extremes of the other side seem to be saying the straight reading of this is wrong? We could just chuck it because it's outdated and irrelevant. But you know me well enough to know that's not usually my approach. So for me, if the text seems wrong, check the context and try and discern what the original heart of this was about, and then decide if it's relevant. It may still not be relevant, but then decide. I'll tell you a story about why context matters, and I'm paraphrasing and using a story my old youth pastor Neil Hart used a long time ago about St. Paul's letter to the people of Perth. St. Paul had given his message to the people of Perth about the freedom of Christ, and it was taken on wholeheartedly by the new Christian community in Perth, and they recognised that in the freedom of Christ they were free from social obligations and structures. So they began meeting in Hay Street Mall naked because they were free, and they were wanting to say, "We are free from the social constructs that say we must be clothed." And Paul's letter to the people of Perth says, I tell you, it is a command of God. You must wear clothes in public. Do not be seen naked. It is a shame on our faith for you to be seen naked. And this letter was then taken by missionaries to people in Central Australia, where it was traditional not to wear clothes. And the missionary said, do not be seen naked in public, because it is a shame on Christ. When I'm talking about context, this is what I'm talking about. What was the heart of the message of St. Paul's letter to the people of Perth? Don't let yourself be labelled as kooky loonies, because it distracts from the point of the freedom of Christ that you're actually trying to share. So, I'm going to look at context for this text in three directions. We're going to talk about the historical context of what was happening when the letter was written. We're going to talk about the context of the rest of the letter, and to some extent the rest of Paul. And we're going to talk about the context of the lens of Jesus. Now, if absorbing a deep dive into the context of Romans is not for you this morning, my invitation is to be present to your context today, right now. What is your historical situation, the life you live, the government you're under? Be present to that. And I'll give you some other pointers as we go. If you don't feel like listening to me, that's fine. So, Paul in Romans is writing to a community he probably hasn't yet met. He has Roman citizenship, but we don't think he's ever lived there. He quite possibly has a reputation as a troublemaker. So, Romans lays out the guts of his message and urges the community to live in love and unity. He's possibly looking to gain support in Rome for a proposed mission trip to Spain. He's possibly trying to convince the Romans that he's not going to cause unrest in the empire if they let him go to Spain. He's probably writing this around 57-58 CE, probably from Corinth, not from prison. He hasn't yet, well, as with everything in New Testament studies, it's disputed, but he's probably not yet been in prison other than a few minor arrests. He hasn't done his time yet. So at this point, the backstory for Rome is that Emperor Claudius in 49 expelled the Jews from Rome because of civil unrest, possibly related to Jewish Christians, it's not clear. In 54, Claudius dies and the Jews start to come back. Now, the Jews were the foundation of the Christian church in Rome. It was a Jewish church, a Jewish missionary church. So after this sort of five-year absence, the Jews start to come back, both into the city but also into the Christian community, which probably has got an increasing Gentile flavour in the period when the Jews were out of the city. Quite possibly not all of them were actually expelled, but certainly the key leaders of the Jewish community were expelled. While they were gone, a key census was taken, and because the Jews weren't there, they were marked as non-Romans. So they're now taxed as non-Romans, even though they're back in Rome. This period in the latter 50s is the early years of Nero's reign, and we know Nero as a tyrant, but it's actually a relatively secure, stable period of administration if you're a Roman citizen. The real tyranny of Nero kicks in a little bit later. Slaves and non-citizens are subject to random acts of state violence, but citizens are protected by a fairly stable system. This reintegration of the Jews into the community, the Christian community, was probably bumpy and is probably one of the reasons that Paul is writing to this community. This Roman church includes slaves, and it also includes people who are officials or important people in the Roman system. So it includes people who are non-citizens who are not protected by Roman law. And it also includes people who are beneficiaries of Roman law and possibly even implementers of Roman law. The latter category also people who could possibly be benefactors for Paul's mission to Spain. Rome in general, not just the Christian community, is very troubled by taxes at this period. There's an unjust and excessive tax system. Tax officials almost had to be corrupt in order to make ends meet. That's how the system was set up. It got so bad, Rome was on the verge of tax riots, and in 58, the Roman citizens sent a petition to Nero asking that he abolish some of the taxes and asking for, because the tax system was so bad. This is not a culture that has lots of petitions, so that's quite a thing. Nero doesn't remove the taxes, but he does tighten up the regulations so that corruption is a bit harder. So you've got this city, a community that's doing its reintegration and changing of its dynamics, a divided and a mixed community socially, in the midst of a city that's quite tense around taxes, probably with some Jewish Christians in the community who are being charged taxes they don't think they have to pay because Roman citizens are exempt from a whole lot of tax, but they're being charged as non-citizens because they were away for the census. Rome's a totalitarian regime. So there's an emperor. The emperor is sometimes influenced by a very small autocratic group of senators. So the majority of people in Rome had no access to a political system, no access to influence. They've had no avenue to imagine changing the system. There's no concept in this period of political influence in politics. There's no idea of Christian members of government. There's definitely no sense that a government might have Christian allegiance. It's just completely foreign. It's an era of an imperial cult where the emperor is seen as appointed by the gods because of his great value and virtue, usually because he's proved himself in military battle, which is the way you achieve glory, and on account of his military glory, the gods give him power, and because he's such a good person, he's such a successful good person in their eyes. And so the emperor then deserves worship and veneration, and they become gods after they die. You can see that could cause trouble for people who hold Christ as the only Lord. This is a world that has no secular. There is no realm that is not the jurisdiction of God. God or gods, depending on which religion you're part of. So if our God is not responsible, then another God is. Now, of course, that's unthinkable to a monotheistic Jew or Christian. So if our God is not responsible, then an evil spiritual power is. So on the whole, it leans towards somehow our God is responsible. So that's the historical context we're working with. The surrounding, if you're only listening to bits today, be present to your surrounding context, your rest of the letter, what else you've absorbed in worship today, what else you understand of Paul from the past, what you're bringing to hearing this today. Paul's writings in general address how to live within the Roman Empire without unwisely provoking the ruler. So at least at face value, Paul advises to submit to the ruler. He talks about living transformed lives of loving service, including loving service to enemies. We heard that bit read today. He talks about conforming yourself to Christ rather than to Nero is the implied thing, rather than to the state, and to be animated by the spirit of resurrection. Romans, the first 11 chapters of Romans kind of lay out the message of the gospel as Paul sees it, and particularly have an emphasis on the unity between Jews and Gentiles and the way that God's love covers and energizes everything. That's 11 chapters of Romans in two sentences. Then chapters 12 through 15 focus on the ethical implications of taking all that on board, the gospel that's been laid out in the first part. So from chapter 2, it's introduced with the pieces that Ken read. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. This overrides Paul's whole ethics section. Avoid what is evil, stick to what is good. Bless your persecutors. Never repay evil for evil. If your enemy is thirsty, give him a drink. If she's hungry, give her food. Do not be mastered by evil. Master evil with good. And from there, straight into obey the authorities, pay your taxes, give to those you owe what you owe, tax. If you owe them fear, give them fear. If you owe them respect. And then from verse 8, immediately after the key piece, the only thing you owe is love for one another. Love does not harm a neighbour. Love is the fulfilment of the law. Chapter 14 urges the Jews and Gentiles to live in harmony, not to squabble about food laws and religious practices. Chapter 15 emphasises live for each other, not for yourself. Do what's needed to support the weaker members of the community. And then there's sign-offs and blessings and plans to go to Spain and things like that, and it finishes. So that's the context of the rest of the letter that this piece is within. The third piece of context I want to talk about is the lens of Jesus. So if you're today being present to your context, right now, what of Jesus is important to you that you hold central as you encounter any text? And I could, you know, talk for days about this, but I'm just going to choose a few things that I think are relevant. There's a piece that Jesus is recorded as saying that's very, very similar to this about rendering to Caesar what is Caesar's. It's very similar to verses 6 and 7. When the religious officials tried to trap Jesus, this is in Mark chapter 12, tried to trap Jesus by, they wanted him to either rebel against Caesar, then they had a case against him, or to support Caesar and then all the people would hate him. So they said, you know, who do we have to pay taxes or not? And he picked up a coin and very cleverly said, whose face is on it? Caesar's face. We'll give to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God what's God's. I think that's very important to hold that piece of Jesus' teaching when we come to it in Paul. Jesus was killed by Roman authorities, even though he was innocent, which significantly undermines the logic of the middle of this passage about you don't have anything to fear if you're keeping the law, because the law is only a fear for people who break it, except Jesus, who didn't break it and got killed. But it does, Jesus being killed by the Roman authorities does emphasise the keep your head down if you want to avoid the sword piece of the text. Jesus told his disciples, take up your cross. If you take up your cross, you are in the line of the sword. If you keep your head down, as Paul suggests here, you might stay safe. If you make a rebellion, stand up, get in the way. Jesus said it very plainly. Take up your cross was not, it might be hard work. Take up your cross was, if you follow me, you will probably be killed by the state. And that was very realistic advice from Jesus to Roman-occupied Palestine. So how does Jesus' advice about the cross apply in the imperial capital? I would say probably more than ever in the seat of the Roman Empire. Jesus taught, you are the light of the world. That's why we sang that song today. You are the salt of the earth. You are the city on a hill. Which at face value to me seems to contradict, keep your head down and do what the emperor says and don't get in the way. Jesus taught love of neighbour as the supreme guiding principle, including love of enemies, just as Paul does in these three chapters. Jesus taught welcoming tax collectors, welcoming them into discipleship. And this is a passage that very much involves tax. So that's the context we're in. What are we going to do to make sense of the text? I think the heart of this whole section and the gist of Jesus' teaching is love one another. And somehow Paul seems to think that obeying the Roman authorities is a manifestation in his context of loving one another. Why would that be? here's some suggestions. And none of them are watertight arguments. A tax riot would bring down the wrath of the empire on the church. It would label the church as troublemakers. It would divert attention from the message the church was about into something else. And it would possibly get them all killed. So you might be up for challenging the empire yourself, but your actions have implications for the other Christians in your community. So you can't just take up the fight for your own gain without considering the community. You might feel you've been unjustly taxed, but if you protest against that, other Christians in the community may feel the sword of the emperor. Interestingly, this passage, some of the Greek address of you, some of it is singular and some of it is plural. The middle section in particular is singular, you singular, rather than you community. And I think that's not a coincidence. I think that's to do with this sense of if you as an individual take this act, us as a community will feel the impact. I think the situation Paul is writing into is quite similar to American Muslims today. A minority that is watched by the general public for signs of a rebellion. So a Muslim Paul today might write to American Muslims and saying, don't join protest against the government. And whatever you do, don't burn the flag. Because the message that gets out is not going to be Islam frees you from the constraints of the military-industrial complex. The message that's going to get out is these people are traitors. And you burning your flag might be a white Western Muslim without a headscarf, and you're not going to be impacted. But the African and Asian Muslims in your community will feel the repercussions. So Paul says to the Romans, you might be in a position of comfort and security. Perhaps you're a wealthy Roman citizen. But the community includes non-citizens who, even in this relatively stable period of Rome, are not protected by the law. They're not protected from the repercussions of your righteous actions. If some stop obeying the law to make a point about allegiance to Christ rather than allegiance to Caesar, it might not be the ones with the loudest voices who do the most suffering. So love one another. Keep your head down so that those who don't have the protections that your status offers don't suffer for your boldness. It might be that Paul's implying it's fine to take up your cross, but not to send the whole community off to the cross on your behalf. It may just be really practical advice from Paul about community safety. Do not mess with the authorities who carry swords and have the authority to use them. It could just be as straightforward as that. It comes within a sense of bless those who persecute you, including corrupt tax collectors. How do you love a corrupt tax collector? Then the issue of tax becomes not an issue of justice and rights. What do I have a right to? But an issue of love and relationship. Paul's saying you're not to take the law into your own hands. In chapter 12, he says, don't take vengeance. And then in chapter 13, he says, let the empire do that or wait for eternity. It's not your role. And don't get trapped into arguing about side issues. This is an allusion to Jesus' response to the trick question about paying tax. In verse 7, he says, pay what you owe to the secular authorities, essentially. Pay tax, respect. He uses two different words for tax because the issue of the tax was about two different sorts of tax. One you could tax directly. It was like the GST and income tax. And so he's using the two different words. Pay what you owe to secular authorities. And then in verse 8, he says, but the only thing you really owe is love. It's almost like he's taken the piece from Jesus about give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God's what is God's. And in verse 7, he spells out what is Caesar's. Tax, fear, respect. And in verse 8, he spells out what is God's. love one another. In your context, in the fullness of all we share in today, what you've brought, what you've heard, with Jesus as your centering, how do you love one another? How do I love one another? So why preface all this? It's good up to there. It's working well. But verse 1 says, the authorities were appointed by God. And that's problematic. I don't like it. Why? Why start with that? And then I have to say, this is where the commentators have spent a lot of time searching for wriggle room. Here's some possibilities, and I can't tell you which one will work for you. One is that the word, it could be talking not that God ordains leaders, but that God orders them, puts them in the proper order, which is beneath God and implementing justice. And therefore, if they are not implementing justice, the implication is they are therefore not ordered by God. So there's an implied critique and standard there that while it says obey them because they're in God's place, it's actually saying, and that would mean this, and therefore you don't have to obey them because they're not doing that. It's also possible that it's not an elevation but a demotion for the emperor. The emperor is not God's virtuous representative, but God's servant. The emperor is not a law unto himself. The emperor is answerable to God. And God expects the ruler, says in verse 3 and 4, God expects the ruler to uphold good and punish evil. Now this would be of comfort to people in Rome to know that their emperor is under God's judgment. This is a standard Jewish view, and if you've been listening to me talking about Jeremiah, you'll be hearing echoes of how they talked about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was God's servant to destroy the people of Israel. It comes out of this Jewish logic that God has to be involved because there's only one God, and if it's not God, there's nothing. There's no secular. So there's not a theoretical option to say, this is just a human being brought about by the machinations of humanity. It's just not a conceptual option. By the time we get to the writer of Revelation, which is later, who's also reflecting on the rule of Nero, Nero is no longer reflected on as being God's servant. Nero is seen as the face of spiritual evil. That's a very, very strong statement in that culture where everything is from God except pure evil. To have gone to the extent, that tells you how bad things were under Nero, that they got to the point of saying, actually, we actually think Nero is evil, is not within the realm of what God ordains at all. So this idea, to preface it by saying the emperor is the servant of God, is not to put forward a new idea, but just to state the reality and this is what we all know anyway, kind of a statement. Some people make a great deal of the fact that the word is not obey, but submit. And some argue this is really important. I've worked really hard to try and understand what they meant, and I'm going to try and tell it to you. I have to say I'm not 100% convinced, but people think it's really important, so I'll give it a go. The idea of submit has within it a sense of recognising the roles you're in and treating those roles and people within them with respect. But it doesn't mean do everything they say. So submit calls for a discerning, respectful response rather than a blind obedience, allegiance, which would be obedience. And the parallel is the text around wives and husbands are called to mutual submission, not mutual obedience, which is a relationship of respect rather than a relationship of doing everything someone says. It's possible that Paul anticipated there were imperial spies going to listen to this letter who were looking for a chance to bring him or the community down. So it's a two-faced letter that makes a public statement that they can't be condemned for, while undercutting it with coded language. So it says, obey the emperor. because the emperor controls the sword. But he's just said, you are people of non-violence, no eye for an eye, so the realm of the sword is not your business anyway. It's the world you're not part of. Give the emperor what you owe him. Very good public statement, can't be condemned for that, which is effectively tax and keep out of his way, but not veneration. It's also possible that Paul was expecting Jesus to come back very soon. And so this emperor was the dying vestige of the world Christ had redeemed and was soon to reclaim. So it didn't really matter. He wasn't putting out a political theology for all time because he expected all time to be about 10 years. Or it's possible that Paul, as a male citizen of Rome, experienced the benefits of Roman government and he genuinely thought that Roman rule in the 50s was put in place by God for the greater good. He did get out of imprisonment several times because he was a Roman citizen. It worked well for him. He might not have written the same thing after Nero started wholesale wiping out the Christians in 64, but he was killed in that persecution, so he didn't have the chance to change his mind. I have to be cautious how I read the text from my context because I'm one who benefits from the state I live in. It is really solid, good advice for me to my white children to obey the law and trust the police. And I'm grateful that the police are on the end of the telephone if I feel threatened. It is not solid, good advice to the Aboriginal children who live in my street and go to my children's school to obey and defer to the police in that way. Aboriginal children are 52 times more likely to be imprisoned in Western Australia than non-Aboriginal children. 52 times! That is nearly twice the national rate. They need a healthy fear of the police, not because it's right to fear the police because you fear them if you do wrong, but because they are part of a people who have suffered at the hands of police brutality and prejudice since colonisation began, and they continue to do so. I read this text from a relatively secure context, and I have the luxury of critiquing the system. But in places without a functioning justice system, I wouldn't have that luxury, especially as a woman. A major predictor of poverty is the functionality of a government's justice system. Doesn't matter how many wells we dig, how many goats we give, if the bandits keep raiding the village, the people are still going to be poor. So I need to listen to the people who are crying out for stable law enforcement. It wouldn't be any surprise to anyone that this text has been core in developing theories and doctrines about the relationship between church and state. Both state as politics, but also state as the civic institutions that implement the government's authority, the justice system and the military particularly. And the question always is, what is the role of Christians? Christians who are devoted to the Lord of a coming kingdom, people who are, we are citizens of Shalom of God. What is our role while we live within human history as subjects of other authorities? There are many answers to that question, and they rampantly disagree. And I don't have the space today to go into them. If you'd like me to, I'm happy to give another talk to going into them. But the major differences, one, somewhat surprisingly possibly, is are human beings fundamentally bad, broken, and sinful, or not? Because if human beings are fundamentally bad, broken, and sinful, then human institutions cannot be redeemed and work towards the kingdom. They are a symptom and a factor of our sinful world. And if they're not, then there's hope for redeeming and working for good within systems. Or if the systems are malformed, there is a purpose to fighting against them for a better system. Second major question, if you're taking on political theology, how much influence does God have? Can God institute, use, do things, or is God just allowing, or is God inspiring and energising Christians to be doing, but hands off in the doing him herself? I'm not answering these questions. I'm just telling you these are the questions you need to think about. The third one, which is the most important one in my opinion. Does the love ethic of Christ apply to everything? Or are there aspects of life where coercion might be necessary? Because we are not yet fully formed love beings. When I talk about coercion, I'm talking about the implicit or explicit threat that a person or a system has authority to do me harm, to imprison me, to take my stuff, ultimately to put me to death. Are there realms of my life where I feel, actually, we need some coercion? Or not? Does love your neighbour override the lot? That is the core question in determining how we relate to the state. So how do you follow Christ while living within secular authorities? That's your coffee conversation this morning. Are there limits for you of where the love ethic applies? And I've been chewing this around for weeks, obviously. And I have to honestly say, it's a challenge to me because when I get to the point I think is my limit, I actually find maybe I'm just making excuses because it's too hard to love. And my gut feeling is we're called to love always. Because ultimately the state can achieve compliance with a very good program, but the state cannot inspire people to love. It's really tricky discerning what loving one another means in public life, especially when Paul adds this layer of not just what is theoretically right, but what does your taking a stand, what does my speaking out mean for people who are more vulnerable than me, especially within the Christian community? So take up the challenge this week as you go out in your context, what you're present to. In all your decisions, in all your discussions, every time you listen to the news, love, love, love. Let your love be the light of the world. And remember that it's not your determination to be good that turns the light on. It's the love of God for you, poured into you. We love because God first loved us.